the Atlantic is ready to make hurricanes. Dan Brown breaks down the process of forecasting one of Mother Nature's extreme storms and the latest trend to make homes more resilient to hurricane impacts and survive the storm. This is NTWC Live.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NTWC Live for Wednesday, May the 24th. Good to have you along today. I'm here along with Bill Reed, former director of the National Hurricane Center, Dr. Hal Needham from the GeoTrek podcast and CNC Catastrophe, hosting the program today. Our guests today include Dan Brown from the National Hurricane Center and Rory Wright from IBHS. So we got a lot to cover today. And we've also got, of course, a typhoon out on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. A lot going on. But before we get to that, we want to thank our sponsors who make this program a possibility each and every week. Of course, USAA. Thank you to USAA. We really appreciate all that they do. The South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, South Padre Island, the host of the National Tropical Weather Conference each year in the month of April. Plans already underway for the 2024 conference. Start making your plans to head to South Padre Island next spring for your update on what's happening in the tropics. The Weather Company, Weather Boy, Live View, all sponsors for the National Tropical Weather Conference. We appreciate all that they do. All right, let's get over to Bill Reed, former director of the National Hurricane Center. Bill, good morning to you.
Good morning, Tim. You're right. We got a full day, so I'm going to jump right into it. And it's always a pleasure to have on our show former colleagues of mine from the Weather Service. And this morning, we're bringing in Dan Brown. He's the warning coordination meteorologist. Which is it's kind of like other duties is assigned. He's also a senior hurricane specialist in the hurricane specialist unit there. Dan has been in the Miami office, the Hurricane Center, and the forecast office, where he had a three-year stint since 1993. I can't believe you got 30 years of service on the books already, Dan. And he's got numerous awards, both internally and externally, recognized by the National Hurricane Conference, the Florida Governor's Conference, and the Isaac Klein Award, which is a very big item to get if you're a forecaster in the National Weather Service world. So Dan's going to talk to us about a little bit of the under the hood stuff of how they go about making hurricane warnings and forecasts. So Dan, show's yours.
Here, thanks. Thanks, Bill. Great to hear from you and to get to talk this morning. Let me see if I can share my screen, and I do have a few slides here that put together to kind of go, you know, talk about our forecast process and how we make the actual forecast. Let me get that in presentation mode if I can here. Give me one second. There we go. Okay, got it in presentation mode. Got that first slide up. So yeah, thanks, thanks Bill, thanks Alex and Tim for having me today. I really look forward to chatting. I know a lot of folks see the end product that we issue with the Hurricane Center with the advisories and forecasts and warnings, but there really is a lot of things that go into that process, and kind of just try to describe some of those here this morning. And Bill, please interrupt with questions. Give me a shout if you want to stop, and if I didn't quite clarify something, let me know. I definitely want to do that. So just for folks' awareness, it's really a three-hour process that we have to issue a forecast, and it starts at each of the synoptic hours in the eastern time during the main part of the hurricane season. That's 8 a.m., 2 p.m., 8 p.m., and then also 2 a.m. overnight. And again, each of those cycles takes about 3 hours. The first 30 minutes to 45 minutes, that's where we're doing the analysis part. And then it gives us about an hour to actually sit down and make the forecast. And then we coordinate the hazards with local offices, other national centers, coordinate watches and warnings. And then it gives us about 30 to 45 minutes to actually work on the messaging, work on that public advisory discussion. And you can kind of see that timeline here. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail than that here. Through parts of that process. But one thing I did also want to remember is before all of that starts, just that we have the invest as well. And so we're doing this process even when things haven't yet formed by updating, doing an analysis on the system, updating what we call a best track, where it's located, where it's been, and then looking at running the guidance, making those forecasts. So, when we open an invest, what does it allow us to do? It really helps us to then monitor these disturbances more carefully, collect some additional satellite data, record what we call fixes or estimates of where the storm is located. Again, running that model guidance, I just remind folks, so, you know, there's no real standard for us to open these invests, that it's kind of up to our forecaster discretion. We actually only have to update that information every 12 hours. Typically, we do it every 6, but really only have to do it every 12. And then we typically start running that guidance when there's a cloud system center apparent. And then, you know, a good reminder for folks that there's an awful lot of uncertainty when it comes to the invest. They're just not as well-defined. Model guidance is kind of all over the place. So be a little careful when you're looking at some of these invest plots. So, you know, the overall timeline, and I think most folks listening are probably aware, but just kind of walking you through again, when does the information come out of the Hurricane Center? So at 5 a.m., you'll get this complete advisory package where we get the public advisory, a forecast discussion, those wind speed probabilities, the cone, and all those graphics comes out at 5 a.m. The next one comes out at 11, 5 p.m., 11 p.m., and then, of course, the next morning, 5 a.m. In between that time, if there's watches and warnings in effect, that's when we issue what's called the intermediate public advisory, not a new forecast, but a new intensity, a new motion, and a new location of where the system is, again, providing some more flow of information when watches and warnings are in effect. And then if we get in a situation like Ian, where we have a system where it's pretty well defined on radar heading toward the coast, that's when we put out information every single hour where we issue these tropical cyclone updates to provide that very latest information. So how is all that information then done? I think I'll skip that slide here. Again, it starts with this advisory preparation time. Think of this as one of the synoptic hours. So 12Z in the morning, say 8 a.m., I'll kind of walk us through that. Again, it's that first hour we're doing all the analysis part of the cycle. So what are we doing? What do we have to first do? We have to very first, you know, ask ourselves these three questions. Where is the storm located? You know, latitude, longitude. From that, we can get the motion. How strong is the storm? What are those maximum sustained winds? And then how big is the storm? What are the wind radii? How far do those winds, both tropical storm, 50 knots, and then also hurricane force, how far do they extend from the center? Again, that's all crucial information to help us in analysis and start the baseline for that forecast. So what are we using for data for that? So we're using geostationary satellites. Again, that's helping us determine that center location, intensity. We have folks here at the Hurricane Center and the Tropical Analysis and Forecast Branch that are using what we call the Dvorak technique. You'll hear us talk a lot about that in our forecast discussion. It's estimating intensity from satellite. We also use low Earth orbiting satellites like microwave imagery, scatterometer to look at storm structure, look at those winds over the ocean. And then if the system is a threat to land, that's where we're using things like reconnaissance aircraft, again, to help with not only location of the storm, but also intensity and size. Surface observation, ship buoy, land-based sites can be pretty helpful. But again, we want ships to scatter and not be in the path of the storm, so they can kind of be limited. A buoy certainly help with that. And then as systems near land, that radar information can be really critical. There is a decent radar network now across the Caribbean. We actually can look at some of that international radar imagery as well to help with the center location. Once we determine where the center is located, that's where we're then going to determine how strong the storm is. What is that system's intensity? And you can see a plot here. This is from Dorian. And you can see all these various estimates on this plot. So the ones in blue are mainly from satellites. The ones that are colored with red and some of the triangles there, that's our aircraft information we're getting. So, you know, aircraft is providing flight level wind information that we can reduce to the surface depending on what flight level. There's different reduction factors. And then we get that step frequency microwave radiometer data. It's estimating the winds at the surface of the ocean. We're also getting those drop sons and where they're providing that profile of the winds in the atmosphere. Again, we're getting also pressure data, central pressure information when aircraft goes through the center. I will just say that as a forecaster, there's a lot of uncertainty, and also you get conflicting pieces of information. Drop sonde or flight level winds may say it's, you know, this level intensity, say 100 knots, and then you get the SFMR saying it's less or even higher. And so, again, it's that forecaster is often putting together, weighing all these various pieces of information to come up with our final answer on the strength of the storm. Lastly, we then estimate storm size. So how far out do those winds extend in the various quadrants? This is really important when it comes to the placement of watches and warnings, and also for timing when those winds are going to arrive. So we do these in four quadrants. We're analyzing both, you know, northeast, southeast, southwest, and northwest portions of the storm, and essentially looking for the largest distance from the center that those winds extend. When we don't have a lot of data, it's often estimated from satellite, looking at kind of the storm, you know, the extent of the colder cloud tops and the extent of the deep convection in the storm. Whereas if we have aircraft, then we're actually able to start help measure, you know, how far out those winds extend, and then also ASCAT can really come into play, helping with, say, the tropical storm force wind analysis. And so in summary, I wanted to summarize with this slide. So when we talk about the analysis piece, not the forecast piece, this is the uncertainty we think there is with our estimates, both of intensity and size. So we think we're good to within about 10%. And that's why sometimes you'll see after the fact, even with Ian last year, we ended up making Ian briefly a Category 5 in the Gulf. Again, because there's these uncertainties, when we have time to go back and really look at the data, we sometimes make these adjustments, but we believe we're good in real time to within about 10%, meaning that, you know, if we have 120 mile per hour hurricane, it could be about 105 to 110 miles per hour, or it could be as strong as maybe 130 to 135, about 10% plus or minus, which means that 120 mile per hour hurricane could be a Category 2, maybe even Category 4. Again, that's about the grounds for the intensity uncertainty. And then with those wind radii, how big is the storm? We believe we're good within about 25% for hurricane or for tropical storm force, and then maybe about 40% for hurricane. So again, if we're saying those radii extend out about 100 miles from the center, it could be 75 miles, it could be 125 miles. And again, if the storm's moving at about 10 knots, that may be a 4 or 5 hour difference in when those winds might arrive. Again, that's that typical analysis uncertainty, not really the forecast uncertainty. And I think I'll pause there to see, Bill, if there's any questions or if you want to add anything up to this point before I get into really now moving into the forecast part.
Yeah, I would imagine it's you have two forecasters on all the time, and there's others, especially on the day shift around there. Is there much, do you collaborate much as a group on this aspect of the forecast?
We do, and you're right, Bill. There are two forecasters on every shift at the Hurricane Center. And typically when we get a U.S. threat, you know, one person is generally focused on the forecast, but the other person is helping analyze the data coming in so they can be real helpful. You know, the aircraft data is always flowing in essentially when we're doing the forecast process. So things are pretty dynamic. They can be changing, and that extra forecast really is helping with that. And also can provide kind of a second opinion. I know during Ian last year, when it had kind of rapidly strengthened overnight, the day it made landfall eventually to that day, Robbie Berg and I were on, and we had to spend some time, you know, analyzing that intensity. We had some, again, conflicting data, had to come up with the initial intensity of Ian. So yes, it is done in kind of a collaborative process with the two forecasters that are on.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I'll move a little bit further here in the process. So again, this gets us kind of through that first hour where we've now done the, analyze a storm. We then actually have to send that information off to our supercomputers up in Washington, D.C. And that's then when we get back those spaghetti models and spaghetti plots. And we don't look at those spaghetti plots really in a vacuum. We really, look at those model fields. Why is one storm taking it one direction versus another? We're able to really dive into that. And we do a lot of that actually before this process even begins, because we do get, at least the global models are coming in before those synoptic hours. So we're doing that. And then once we get to about this point here, about an hour in, that's when we're actually sitting down and then making that forecast. And, you know, track forecasting is kind of relatively simple problem. The models have certainly gotten better over the last few decades. Higher resolution modeling, more observations go into these models. And so the analogy here is that, you know, the hurricane's kind of like a cork in the stream, that the atmosphere is the river, and there's large scale features that are steering that hurricane. And because the global models do a really good job at forecasting these larger scale features, We tend to do better with forecasting track. And again, it's a little bit kind of the easier part of the forecast in most cases, not always, but in most cases. So we sit down and then actually use the spaghetti models are actually making that track forecast. We want to make changes to that track kind of slow because we don't want to be windshield wipering back and forth. We, you know, that there is a strong constraint on that previous forecast. We want to make these changes in pretty smaller increments. The bottles can do this, but we want to try to send more of a consistent message. And that's not only with the left right, but also with the forward speed. And that's kind of called tromboning. So we don't want to speed the forecast up, slow it down, speed it up again. We're trying to provide this consistent information for emergency managers and others to help make those decisions. And generally, this approach works for us. I'll show you a case here. This was back from Laura just a few years ago, where you know, we were forecasting that storm to hit towards the southwest of Louisiana. This was the cycle. This was our used for the afternoon forecast at 5 p.m. Package. And then you can see here, as I flip through, you can see all the track guidance. I'll go back and forth a little bit. You can kind of see all that forecast guidance start to shift a little bit to the left. In this case, with this darker blue line, we really didn't change our forecast. We kind of wanted to hold steady with the forecast as those models started making that initial shift to the west. The next cycle, almost all bulk of the guidance kind of moved more into northeastern Texas. But again, we kind of held steady on that right side of the guidance. Again, we were kind of seeing this shift occur, but we didn't want to, again, move our forecast all the way over. So we just nudged it a little bit to the left. And then what ended up happening was, again, all of that guidance ended up shifting back towards southwest Louisiana. And I think this is, again, where our experience and our expertise comes in. We've had other cases where we've you know, taken this approach, and it really has benefited us. And just to show this, to reiterate this, and Mike may have shown this last week when he was talking to everyone, but the human is helping out. And, you know, if we look at our consistency and error versus the individual models, this is for the day four forecast, you can see that we are lower and more consistent than those models. So, again, this approach is working, and that's what we're doing as forecasters. That's so much where expertise comes in, is to, again, make those changes to that forecast kind of gradual but consistent. Shifting gears just a little bit over to intensity forecasting. Again, this is more complex. It's the second step in our process. Once we make the track, we focus on intensity. Again, it's the reason it's more complex is, again, it's a lot smaller scale. We're looking at sort of the thunderstorms, how they interact with the surrounding environment, you know, in the ocean, not just, again, these larger scale processes like we do with track where there's large scale features. It's more of these internal processes, you know, eyewall replacement cycles. Again, a lot of this is not as well understood, not as well modeled. And so, again, you know, it is more difficult with track, although we are showing some improvements here recently. One thing with track is, too, we use our statistical models, our ship's guidance is really telling you what's normally going to happen. Here's the situation, the storms at this speed with these parameters. You know, we use the GFS and European to get, you know, measures of shear, you know, how warm is the sea surface temperature, what's the mid-level humidity going to be. And so it basically takes all those parameters and forecasts what normally should occur. So it's not going to get the outliers. It's not going to forecast really those rapid changes in the strength. And also, when we talk about track forecasting, or excuse me, intensity forecasting, if there are changes in the track that occur, it can result in different, you know, sea surface temperatures, a different environment that the storm is in, whether or not there's land interaction or not. So those modest changes in the track can sometimes result in what we have to make is changes to the intensity forecast. But we also, with intensity forecast, is again, try to have continuity from the previous forecast, not make big changes. That has benefited us as well. You go back to Ida a couple years ago when it was in the Gulf. There was a few cycles in which the storm kind of plateaued in intensity. It had strengthened, plateaued, and a lot of our guidance started to suggest it wouldn't quite reach Category 4 strength. We held firm in those forecasts. Again, we already had that message out. And then Ida eventually did strengthen that overnight and reach category 4 strength. So again, the approach of making these smaller, more consistent changes seems to help us quite a bit. I mentioned the rapid strengthening. I'll just mention here that, you know, with Ian and with other recent storms, we have gotten better. Finally, we're starting to see some progress with forecasting rapid strengthening. And, with Ian, our average intensity forecasters were about 10 to 25% lower than the consensus. And then also, we have seen our errors cut in half in just in the last 3 hurricane seasons. We're either forecasting or observing rapid strengthening. And again, I think we're finally seeing some progress there with this part of the forecast. And then finally, I'll finish up with, you know, how do we forecast the storm size? Again, there's a little bit less guidance available for forecasting the wind radii or storm size. But we do use some climatology and persistence models. We do look at the global models, European, GFS. We also get those regional hurricane models, H-Wharf, H-Mon. But there's a little bit more limited skill in forecasting storm size. So there's also, you know, these empirical ideas. If the storm is strengthening, the wind field's likely to expand. You know, if it's weakening, maybe contract. Is the storm going to become extratropical? That's often going to cause the wind field to expand as it moves northward. Is the circulation going to be partly over land where those wind field might contract a bit, you know, or is it accelerating? So we're thinking about these things as we're making those size forecasts as well. I will tell you, it can be a time-consuming part of the forecast process making these, because again, you're making a tropical storm, 58 mile per hour, 50 knots, and then a hurricane force wind radii forecast at each of the forecast times that we issue for. So it can be time consuming, but it's important because that's where we get into looking at the timing. When are those winds going to arrive? When do we need the preparations complete? And that is part of the forecast process. So I'll pause again real quick, Bill, and see if there's any other, you have any questions up to this point.
Yeah, I always, compare the you showed a fairly large degree of variance possible in analyzing the storm size, and that seems like it would just get compounded in the forecasting, especially when you're in a fairly data void area.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think a lot of folks really look at some of the tools where you're looking at a deterministic forecast. And, you know, when this, like on the graphic here, when that blue line touches you, but you really have to think about that as, it could be plus or minus maybe 6 or 12 hours from that. Because, again, not only is your uncertainty in the forecast and the forward speed, but there is this uncertainty even in the size of the storm. We don't have a lot of data to really do a detailed analysis of that wind field. So it's kind of a crude depiction, again, using that maximum extent in each quadrant. And you're right, that can play a difference in timing.
Yeah, are there any tools that help you now on showing changes in the wind field relative to the storm coming over land and the obvious reduction of the sustained wind and going to gustiness?
Sure, we do have some of that, and we're actually working on a newer version of our wind speed probabilities to better account for land. Those wind speed probability products do account for land, but we're hoping to have a better reduction in that product. It's kind of a final product, but yeah, you're right. We have to take land into account as the system's moving over land and adjust those wind radii.
Very good.
So this, the last part of the forecast process, kind of this, you know, last hour is when really everything gets pieced together. It's when the watch warning coordination happens. It's when we're coordinating all the hazard messaging for storm surge, for rainfall, tornado threats. And so there is a coordination call that takes place with all our local National Weather Service offices, the other national centers, and it occurs about an hour before each advisory goes out. So it's about 2 hours into the cycle or an hour before those advisories go out. And it's again, a place for all of us to coordinate messaging and then, again, those watches and warnings. So when it comes to watches and warnings, I want folks to remember that they really are a risk communication tool. It's not saying that those winds are going to happen in every location, but we're trying to use them as a tool to convey the risk. The risk is great enough that we need to put up that watcher warning, and that residents need to take those preparations. So, don't really think of them as a yes, no, but again, think of it as that risk communication tool. And the key is that those conditions are either possible for a watch or expected for a warning, but it's within somewhere within that warning area. Again, not everywhere, but somewhere. And so we, again, account for that uncertainty as we're thinking about the placement of watches and warnings. And this is kind of the considerations that we're thinking about. So again, it's back to continuity, maintaining that continuity with a previous decision. And then sometimes we're thinking about, you know, what are the changes? If there's been a trend toward the east or west, maybe we want to hedge that watcher warning breakpoint just a little further in that direction, knowing that there might be a future change to the forecast. Again, we're assessing that uncertainty. Some cases there's more uncertainty, like in Ian last year, more uncertainty than normal. We might want to make those watch warning areas a little bigger in some of those cases. And then that orientation to the coast. And Ian was coming more parallel to the coast versus something more perpendicular might mean that we have to have a bigger watch warning area as well. Because again, just a small change left to right, system kind of coming up the east or west coast of Florida can make a big difference on where that landfall occurs and who gets those strongest winds. You know, the vulnerability can play a role as well. I know, many years ago after Irma, I think it was Barbuda that was significantly impacted. There was another hurricane following in its footsteps, Jose. And so we put up a hurricane watch a little early just to make sure those folks knew that there was that possibility of another hurricane affecting that area. And then timing considerations play a role. Sometimes we want to make sure the warning gets out maybe in the evening before, because something coming out really late at night or early in the morning may not be as helpful. So we may want to issue those warnings maybe a cycle earlier, say at 5 p.m. instead of something that's going to come out overnight. So again, we're having these discussions on those hotline calls with our local National Weather Service offices to help with the watch warning coordination. I will also mention that we have a huge international responsibility at the Hurricane Center. So we are one of seven regional specialized meteorological centers across the globe. And this is part of the World Meteorological Organization. So we also coordinate our forecasts and warnings internationally, and same with watches and warnings. So each country is responsible for their own watches and warnings, but we will recommend the placement of those. So we will talk to them. Some of it's done now on video teleconferencing capabilities. Sometimes it's through email. Sometimes it's through phone calls and chats. But we will, once we make the forecast, again, recommend, say in the Eastern Caribbean, which islands need to be under a watch warning. It doesn't always mean they'll issue them. Sometimes maybe if there's a lot of uncertainty, there's not as much evacuation on some of the islands. Maybe they decide they want to hold off 6 hours to kind of see if we're going to get more confident in the need for that watch and warning. It's their call. They can do that. Most of the time, this watch warning coordination goes very smoothly. Sometimes it can be complex because sometimes one island would like to know whether the island next to them is going to go under a watch warning. And you remember that one island, St. Martin, there's both a Dutch and a French side. So sometimes they would like to coordinate with each other as to what watch warning they're going to issue for that island. So again, there's always two forecasters on in these situations helping with this. But I threw the map up in the upper right-hand corner just to show that there's a lot of different jurisdictions. It can be time consuming, and not everyone speaks English. We do have Spanish speaking countries, French speaking countries that we do coordinate with as well. And we have folks at the Hurricane Center that can help with that speak multiple languages. So again, once that part is done, we have about an hour to really make these last minute changes. You know, remember, there's always aircraft data coming in these, often in these situations where you might have to even tweak the forecast, update the initial intensity. So all that's occurring. I know there's been times where even during Ian, the case I mentioned earlier, we got information saying that Ian was much stronger about 40 minutes before the advisory went out, which left us having to make a lot of changes in that last few minutes of the forecast. But again, we want to get the most recent and updated information out as soon as we can. And I know that 3-hour timeline is we want to get all the products. It's a hard deadline. We want to get everything out by that. And I know that's when everybody at home is hitting the refresh on our website to get the advisory information out. I'm doing it too. When I'm not at work, I'm doing the same thing I think everybody else is doing, to see what the latest forecast and what we've, you know, what the updates are. And I will also mention, you know, in that process, the amount of coordination that we're doing, I think it's increased. And if you remember, we added a 60-hour forecast point. We're now doing those storm size forecasts, at least internally, out to 5 days. We're doing a day 6 and 7 forecast internally. So there's more stuff we're doing in that 3-hour window. And it's sort of pushing the envelope on making sure we get all these products out on time. And I know with that coordination during Ian, when there were watches and warnings up, we were only getting that forecast advisory out about 5 minutes before the top of the hour. And again, that's because there's so much going on behind the scenes during these cases. So brief overview, kind of, you know, big picture look at, again, what goes on to put out a forecast. Hopefully answer some of your questions, and I can take a few more from you, Bill.
Right. Yeah. Your last comments there about getting it out 5 minutes before, it's not been that many years, decades maybe, since we were challenged to get it out late sometimes because of all the changes, because of the technology didn't exist to quickly produce a forecast. One question that came to mind, it's been, almost 15 years since we increased the lead time on the watches and warnings. Given the growth in the hurricane coastal zones and population and increasing complexities of the actions people have to take, is there any consideration to further extending the lead times on the products?
So, you know, there hasn't been much discussion on that since then. I know you were the director when that change occurred, to go from 24 to 36 hours to 36 to 48 for the warnings and watches. We haven't gotten a lot of feedback suggesting we should make them any longer, but, you know, as you know, and I know, there's an awful lot of preparations and even evacuations that are occurring within the watch phase and even sometimes before for some of the larger metro areas. So, you know, I know decisions are being made at much earlier timelines than even the watches warnings are, but no discussion currently about making them any longer.
Go ahead and unshare your screen.
Really great presentation. You talked about considering timing with late at night versus early in the morning or afternoon. What about timing with like weekends or holiday weekends? Like you get into September on a Saturday afternoon, everyone's at a college football game. Are people less in tune to a forecast than they would be on a Tuesday or Wednesday? And do you make adjustments for that?
Can you unshare your screen?
Probably. Oh yeah, sure. Probably a little bit less. Of that than it is more the time of day. I mean, sometimes, you know, the holiday weekend might come into play when it comes to the overall messaging, what we might put in the key messages, whether we want to make sure folks are paying attention. But I would say it's probably less on the actual watch warning. I think that's mainly for the time of day and knowing that, you know, when folks are going to get it, more kind of a shorter term consideration.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, from a broadcaster perspective, we appreciate the cognizance of news time and having that advisor out 5 minutes before the newscast rather than 5 minutes into it.
I get a lot of comments about that, and we try to get those out as quick as we can, and just know that when they're closer to the top of the hour, it often means that we're either getting that last minute reconnaissance data in, that we want to get that final pass through to make sure we get the intensity right, or that there's just a lot of watch warning coordination going on behind the scenes that has taken us to closer to the top of that hour. If we don't have those changes or not expecting them, we often will get that advisory out as early as 15, 20, or maybe even up to 30 minutes before that top of the hour. Because again, we want folks to be able to run those graphics, have it ready to go, especially for you know, newscasts in the afternoon and evening when it's crucial to have that information.
We appreciate that more than you know. Let me bring you one question from online. We're getting several, but let me ask one. Casper wants to know if we could ever see a graphical representation of the forecasted wind field, a graphical representation.
So there are products out there that you can do that. We don't produce a graphical representation of the wind field. One is because, you know, if the track shifts a little bit left or right or faster, slower, or the storm size changes, I mean, it doesn't take much to have that to not be correct. And so we don't want people to focus too much on that exact wind swath, let's say. But there are tools that emergency managers use, such as HURVAC, where people can look at that wind swath, that exact forecast. We'd rather have people looking at things like our wind speed probabilities, again, to look at their wind risk rather than that deterministic forecast. There is a graphical depiction on an initial wind field graphic of the analysis of the initial wind field at the advisory time that we do provide.
All right, Bill, thank you, Dan. Great stuff, and I hope you can stick around for some more Q&A a little bit later on because we may have some more. But, Bill, why don't you give us an update on the typhoon out there?
Yeah, unless you think otherwise, I think I'm going to move that to the end because our next guest has a locked-in time constraint at the top of the hour. So I'm going to turn it over to Hal and a quick info on the geo trek and what he's got, which I think is related to our next speaker. Hal?
Yeah, it is, everyone. We're so excited to bring you a geo trek spotlight every week. Geo trek's all about getting out there in extreme weather and natural disasters, understanding the impacts of those events, and then how we can reduce that through mitigation. And so we have a little video clip we're going to show you here, just an overview of geo trek, and then a really interesting conversation that we had with Alex Carey from IBHS, which relates to our next speaker, Roy Wright from IBHS, who's here with us on the broadcast today.
You know, and let's talk about this. I've heard this saying recently that a test is worth more than 1,000 expert opinions, right? I think one of the really good tests we've seen for IBHS and Fortified was when Hurricane Sally hit Alabama, really South Alabama and the extreme Western Florida panhandle in September of 2020. And the reason I say that, it rapidly intensified into a Cat 2 hurricane. It was moving really slow, but it hit a part of the country, really Baldwin County, down there where there are a lot of fortified homes per capita, at least compared to other houses. Could you share a little bit about the results from a Cat 2 hurricane hit? How did Baldwin County do? How did the fortified houses do really in that hurricane zone taking a direct hit from Category 2 Sally?
Yeah, so I think for those of us that live in hurricane-prone regions, I think when you say Category 2, sometimes there's a little bit of sort of lackadaisical approach to even a Cat 2 just because we've been through it so many times. The challenge, and one thing you mentioned that was really unique about Sally is that she was very slow moving. So it was you know, the homes in the path were subjected for many, many hours. I live in Baldwin County, and, you know, I think we were in the eye wall for 6 or 7 hours worth of 110, 120 mile per hour wind. So it was really intense for a long time. And that does provide additional stress than maybe a normal storm that would blow sure. through. And we had about 17,000 homes in the path of Sally at the time. And we had less than 100 that had, you know, any kind of real noticeable damage. And you know, so all of those homes fared incredibly well. Many, many fortified roofs performed as they should. And like I mentioned earlier, no, we're not disaster proofing anything. So folks might have lost some shingles that might have loosened during the storm and blown off, but they did not get that water intrusion that most of the time you would see happen after roof cover loss. You normally a lot of water comes in. And through the roof because of that. And those homes fared incredibly well. And we had a lot of roofers and contractors and homeowners just really, really feeling positive about the program and their decision to go with a fortified roof and a fortified home.
Yeah, all of a sudden when the hurricane comes knocking on your door and you do not have the damage that your neighbors have, that really makes a huge difference, right?
It makes a very big difference. And we actually saw a huge uptick in fortified roofs after that because of that very fact that we had a lot of neighborhoods where, you know, either existing neighborhoods where there have been a, you know, maybe a handful of homeowners that had retrofitted their roofs to fortified and their, you know, the rest of their neighbors didn't fare so well. And so they, you know, and all of a sudden they're like, well, who did your roof? What's your roof? You know, what's on there? And so then that word spread pretty quickly. So we really, as well as with our, you know, some of the local leadership, we had a lot of social media stuff going around from code officials and others spreading the word, you know, if you're building back and you lost your roof, put it on fortified. So made a big difference.
Alex.
Okay.
That was from a clip that I had with Alex Carey from IBHS, the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. Really interesting conversation we had there on the GeoTrek podcast. I'm going to share my screen here real briefly and just narrate for a minute or two, and then we're going to go to our next interview. I really enjoyed that conversation with Alex Carey. We were talking about the success from IBHS and the Fortified project to really get out there and reduce losses. We were talking about Hurricane Sally and just how amazingly well the fortified roofs did in South Alabama. South Alabama has a lot of fortified roofs, and they did really well in a slow-moving upper-level Cat 2 hurricane there in Hurricane Sally back in 2020. And that GeoTrek podcast, you can find its podcast episode number 47 on the GeoTrek podcast called Building Better to Mitigate Disasters with Alex Carey and IBHS. You can find it right there on the podcast. Well, you know, really interesting. Check out, you can always check out Fortified Roofs and information about Smart Home America and these other projects that are out there. It's really just amazing to see how mitigating these things and building for these natural disasters can help reduce losses. And we're going to get into the next podcast or the next interview here in just a moment, where we're going to get into more of the backstory behind IBHS and how they do this amazing work. I wanted to mention as well, with the GeoTrek project, we're all about getting out and going into any kind of extreme weather or natural disasters to understand how we can build better for them. And so we actually spent some time out in California this past year, where they had tremendous amount of snow on houses and buildings. There were 15 to 16 feet of snow on many of these roofs. And so we did a podcast episode number 70 called The Value of Local Knowledge, Building for Epic Snow Loads in the Sierras. That podcast just came out about 2 weeks ago. And what we learned from this is, whether it's hurricane winds, tornadic winds, heavy snow loads, flooding, whatever it is, no matter how extreme the disaster, no matter how extreme the weather event, we can actually build for it to reduce losses. And that's what we're all about in the GeoTrek podcast, getting out and reducing those losses through a lot of these conversations and interviews with people. Well, hey, everyone, I'm going to stop the share of my screen here. And I'm really excited to introduce our next guest, because his work relates very well to what we're talking about here. Roy Wright is a disaster safety expert and recognized resiliency shaper. He's president and chief executive officer of the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, or IBHS. A former Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, official, Roy joined the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety in 2018 with experience in property insurance, risk management, mitigation, climate adaptation, and resiliency planning. Roy, thank you so much for taking time to come on NTWC.
It's so great to be with you all today.
Roy, could you give us an overview about IBHS? I mean, just from a big picture, what's this work that you're doing and how do you go about it?
Yeah, so the insurance industry, the property insurance industry, came together about 40 years ago to work on these topics about where disasters intersect with people in the built environment. But 15 years ago, they put together a hefty sum of money to build this facility where I'm sitting here today. I got a really quick 30-second video clip. We'll go ahead and hit go on, and I'll give you some pieces that are there. You get the sense everything's done at full scale here. Wind, rain, wildfire, and hail elements that are sitting here. We're the only facility that can handle embers at full scale, can handle hail at full scale. There are other research institutes that do work on wind particularly, but everything has to get downscaled. And so when this place was built, six-story hangar, 105 turbines that can recreate winds of 135 to 140 miles an hour. We can take elements of what happens out in the wild and do something about them. And so our work is that point where Mother Nature meets the built environment. We pay attention to the broader work across the weather enterprise, but particularly at that intersection, because, you know, we can't stop the tornado or the hurricanes we were talking about earlier, wildfires for that matter, from an ignition. But we do know enough to narrow the path of that destruction. I think the Sally pieces you just ran in front of me really highlight that element.
Roy, how far out do you plan your test? Like, we know that sometimes there'll be a massive tornado outbreak or a huge, it'll be a big hail season or something like that. How much flexibility do you have to cater your test to what's recently impacted the built environment?
Yeah, so two things can be true at the same time. There is a two-year view on the research agenda that is here, and about a six-month window by which the schedules are pretty well known. And all of that can be push and pulled related to reality. and what's playing out there, because not only is it our job to fill the gap on the science, we have a really important role to translate that in terms of the influencer. And so part of the time, we have the B-roll ready from a test that was going on 2 or 3 months ago, and we can bring that directly into people's living rooms, working with local broadcasters or some of the national players to fill that particular piece. And other times we'll just disrupt what was planned. And over the course of a couple of days, we can switch out one set of things that was on the research plan and put something else in there because we think it has the right communication effect.
Roy, professionals that are involved in improving the built environment, they often focus a lot on how important the roof is. Could you explain why that's so important?
So once you get beyond the wildfire ignitions, in the property industry, insurance industry, as many as 90% of property claims initiate with the roof. Whether that's hail, wind, rain, water penetration that is in that space. And, you know, most of the United States, upwards of 80% of residential homes in the United States have asphalt shingles that are put on them. There are only two countries in the world that choose to put a disposable product on their roof, the United States and Canada. No other place has this happened. And people say, well, I've got a 25-year roof. I've got a 30-year or a 40-year roof. So the research says that on a bad weather day, you're going to reach your outer limit somewhere between 8 and 10 years after installation. And so we do a profound amount of work on roofs, new products, but also aged products. I literally have a farm just outside of here with 90 roofs that we're aging at 2, 5, 7, 10 years down the road. So we can understand those pieces. You know, we think about some of the fortified dimensions. And fortified, one of its calling cards is the fact that on a very severe weather day, where we see the upper limits of those winds, we may lose the shingles. But it includes a sealed roof deck, something that has cost a few $100 at the point of installation. And it ensures that you do not get water intrusion. So why is that important? Well, I'll talk about it financially, and then I'll just talk about life. At a financial point, when you have water intrusion, there's usually a 5 to 7 time multiplier on the cost of repairing that damage. But here's the flip side. If you don't have water intrusion, you can have a blue tarp put on that house, and you can move back in after the evacuation orders are lifted. Your life may be disrupted, but you're not displaced. And I think that really is at the forefront of these elements. I hope people have insurance for these pieces, and people should have confidence if they have that insurance, it's going to pay out. But even when you are insured, you still want to be able to go home. You want to make sure your contents were not all soaked up and rotting, and ultimately, particularly in high humidity areas, infected with mold.
Well, you mentioned the term of a fortified building. Could you explain to us a little bit about the fortified program and what that means?
Absolutely. So three levels of fortified. The first one, the fortified roof, can be done at new construction, but also retrofit. Anytime you're re-roofing, you could add these dimensions. And there's three very simple elements. First of all, the roof deck, that that board that has gone down, the 4x8 sheets, is put in with ring shank nails so that if you ever got to that point, it's a bit more of a screw effect that is there and it's not going to rip up. We seal the roof deck. Those seams between the 4x8 plywood sheets are sealed in a way that you cannot get water intrusion. Because when you get water intrusion, if you get an inch of water inside of an hour, an inch of precip inside of an hour to fall on a average 2,000 square foot home, that can produce 9 bathtubs worth of water that has now filled the house. And then we know that from a wind perspective, it's very the edges that are most vulnerable, and so that there is an edge treatment that's put in. That's the fortified roof. There are two other levels that are really almost only done at the point of new construction. Fortified silver, which has the roof, but then addresses your openings, whether that's windows, doors, and a real big attention to garage doors. You know, you watch these fantastic elements where roofs pop off of homes. What happens? It's because you have had an element by which there's been a pressure change inside the house. You get this kind of piece that is there. And so when that, when you watch those elements, when we see that vulnerability play with the garage door, it's what opens up the side in those elements. And then the third level of that is fortified gold. Fortified gold deals with the whole continuous load path, and avoiding these elements that you're seeing here when wind plays in. Again, this is a place where we got to have the science, but we also have to show people the images like you're seeing here. This is what's happening at the point that you've evacuated inside your home. The fortified program is meant to have those levels, and it comes with a verification piece. Oftentimes insurers provide price considerations as a result of it. And I think the best case point on that is what we've seen there in southern Alabama.
Right, you brought up a really good point with sealing the roof deck, right? So people might evacuate. They might say, well, worst case scenario, we're going to have some wind damage, but thank God we're not in the flood zone, right? And then right. They come home if they didn't have the sealed roof deck and they find out water's been pouring into their living room for 12 hours during the storm or something like that.
Yeah, you know, you think about this. I spent years as the chief executive of National Flood Insurance at FEMA, and so I know a whole lot about water coming in through your front door. And you need flood insurance for that side. But we see just as much water coming through the roof, and that's the part where your standard homeowners kicks in. We're watching a piece here where we had that side by side. The green one on the right is fortified, conventional on the left. This was picking up data from Hurricane Florence on the Carolina coast 9 hours into the event. And again, we can look at what happens as the building fatigues in these pieces. We know that 9 hours into being battered by the layers wrapping through, we're going to lose some parts of those shingles. We want to make sure that you don't get that water intrusion side of the equation.
Roy, last question for me, and then we'll open it up. Do you know, I know more and more we have storm chasers that are out there actually trying to document the science. Do you know of any cases where storm chasers have actually filmed like a fortified house during a hurricane in the field or even a side-by-side and out in, out in the world?
I don't have storm chaser version of that. But I have a corollary, which is to say we have security camera footage where, and we've seen this on some of our wildfire stuff as well. There's so many cameras now that are on the front porches of homes, and we see these pieces where the house next door is gone. And we can watch what the storm looked like and felt like, and you get that after picture that plays.
Yeah, fantastic. Roy, really appreciate
you. You see this piece here where you can literally watch that element where that we can do here inside the lab where what happens when that not fortified home experiences that extended wind.
Yeah, that's amazing to see that evidence side by side. I wanted to open it up. Have we had any questions come in from online?
Not yet. Just one from the media saying, are you open to the media so we can come watch what you're doing?
So yes and yes. In fact, I'll put up a piece here. We do a lot of work with local meteorologists. I actually think the Weather Enterprise is one of the most important ways for us to convey this information. You all are the trusted folks on the forecast side as well as what to do that is there. And so I'm sitting in a studio here right now where we do live shots and pre-recorded pieces with local media every single week. And when we have the events that are here, we can notify folks and they'll often want to come and see. Not every day am I blowing something out the back door. Sometimes what we built actually survives, right? And that the day watching the wind blow is interesting, but not quite as fantastic as the live TV side of the equation. We do work with some of those national shows that play off on our local TVs every morning. They want an assurance that they're going to see something fantastic in those spaces. But reach out to us here at IBHS, Connie Breedlove, who works these pieces for me on my team. And we're happy to play, whether it was supporting things on social media or providing this information, more B-roll than you probably could ever use in that space across the natural hazards, all available for you.
Another question that's coming in is, you know, we're talking a lot about roofs, and that seems to be the one place that really makes a difference. But is there any other area of the home or of a structure that really matters like the roof does?
Yeah. The next one is the garage door. And this plays in tornado as well, derecho as well as hurricane pieces. There are storm certified garage doors, and they need to become not just more common, but they need to become the standard that is in this place. Because what we keep watching when we do our after event investigations on the ground, because it's not just what we do here, we go out in the field after the event and you look at those pieces, what caused the structure to be compromised is going to be the element related to the failure of the garage door.
And one other question from online, this can be garage door and roof as well. What's the price point for a fortified roof? And is it affordable to the average homeowner?
Absolutely. So on the price point on a fortified roof, when it's done at the point you are re-roofing, and most folks are going to need to re-roof every decade or so, it adds $500 to $700 to the price, right? So we're looking at something that is not free. But when you're spending $15,000 to $20,000 to re-roof, that element is rather marginal in terms of the investment. On the garage door side of the equation, it adds a few hundred dollars to the price of the garage door. Again, incremental things that aren't free. Not everyone can afford, but many Americans, those are the kinds of things that are within the reach of the resilient investment that they can make on their own.
And so you kind of mentioned this, but when I'm putting a new roof on my house and I'm telling my roofer, hey, I want to do this, I want to do fortified, and they go, I don't know what that is.
So different parts of the country, there are more folks than others. You can go to fortifiedhome.org and you can work with us. We'll help connect you with folks. Along the Gulf Coast, Florida and the Carolinas, this is becoming a more and more regular practice. Finding a fortified roofer is eminently doable. I work with folks then as we get farther into Texas, Oklahoma, and throughout the Midwest. It's not as common, but we can help connect you.
Bill, jump in. I know you probably got questions as well. We've been hogging up all the time here. Go ahead, Bill. But you'll have to unmute first.
Yeah, the people were blowing leaves outside. I thought I'd turn off the mic. I guess the main thing against going with metal roofs is that it costs so much more. Would that be a correct statement?
So I think let's acknowledge that if you're in a hail-prone area, regardless of what you're putting on, you could get damaged by the time you have 2-inch hail. And so let me set aside the hail-prone areas. We're actually watching the price point on metal roofs come down more and more. And metal roofs properly installed are proving to be durable over a much longer period of time. And I think even 4 or 5 years ago, people were looking for quite a 50% increase to walk down that path. We're seeing that price point come down. I've talked with consumers along the Gulf Coast who are seeing it an extra 20%. Interacted with some folks in Mobile County, Alabama, who told me they priced a metal roof and an asphalt shingle roof, and they were within hundreds of dollars of each other. And so I do think as it's becoming more available, those pieces are changing. Aesthetics are everything, right? And so can you find a metal roof that has a particular aesthetic on it that has, you know, a price multiplier on it? Sure. But I do think we're moving down a path by which options are becoming available to folks that price doesn't have to be what drives that choice.
My main aesthetic in this living in Galveston County is that when I come back after a storm, the roof's still there. Don't care what it's.
Well, and we watch this. You know, there's a tremendous amount of data that we were able to collect through imagery post Ian. And so you've got you have asphalt shingles there in Florida, but you also have the tile roofs and the metal roofs. Asphalt shingles performed as you would think they would. The other roof types on the whole, the preliminary data I'm getting from the researchers is quite encouraging.
Great. The other question I had is 15 years of experience now running the lab there. Have there been any things that IBHS has learned that have surprised the scientists working there?
Yes. Now the question is, can I boil it down for you? I think one of them, I was just in the lab earlier today, we're doing some work on siding, And you watched one of the pictures where you watch how the siding falls apart. And for so long, people kept saying about siding, it was an installation error. When a hurricane or a tornado high wind event came through and you were losing your siding, it must be that the nail patterns weren't done properly. Well, what we have found is that's not the issue, because no matter how well it was done or how new it was, whether it's hardy board or vinyl siding, that connecting point between the wall and the gable is actually moving. And so the structure is what's causing the problem, at which point, but what we can see in the lab is the first siding to be lost is in that place. Hey, that's a surprising piece. The element related to pressures inside homes. You know, we started a big campaign when people evacuate to shut the doors, because what we learned in some of the pieces that were going on is what was causing the catastrophic loss of roofs was the pressure change in the house, the balloon popping. Simple acts of closing doors inside a home, that if one of your pieces were compromised, and by the way, never leave the window open. That is not, that wives' tale is old and should go to bed. But you can change those pieces. But now we pull it forward. So many of the new construction homes, that open concept, there aren't doors to close. Those pieces play. I think the work ultimately that you see on sealed roof deck and continuous load path, those are elements by which we have inklings of where it goes, and now it needs to be put into practice. And we see it pulled into ASC 7, put into the International Building Code, the International Residential Code. Downside of that, and maybe the most disappointing piece, is only 35% of American jurisdictions use building codes. Yeah. Most folks think their home was built to some standard or code. You know, you think about it, like, you know, a baby crib purchased in Florida and a baby crib purchased in Georgia, you should have the same confidence in it. And you do, but you should not have the same confidence in a home constructed in Florida versus a home constructed in Georgia. One of them has codes and inspections and verification. And the other is just whatever the builder tells you.
Right. Well, I see we've hit the time where you're supposed to disappear to your next appointment. Thank you so much for being with us, Roy. Always fascinating to hear from your guys.
Absolutely. Thanks. We'll do this again. Appreciate you guys' time today.
Thank you, Roy. Appreciate it, Bill. Great work. Dan, I know you're still out there. Thanks for staying with us the whole time. And Dr. Hal Needham, thanks for your work today as well. Great program. Fascinating stuff. We all learn a lot every time we do this, and IBHS has such great information. And Dan, thank you for your time today. We appreciate you sticking around throughout the program.
Yeah, thanks. No problem. Always great to talk to you all.
All right, guys, that wraps up today's show. We appreciate it. Bill, Hal, Dan, Roy, Alex, everybody. That wraps it up for today. We will see you again next week for another program of NTWC Live.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of NTWC Live Hurricane Center Podcast. If you did, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. And join us next week. This is NTWC Live.